Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppen.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And this week we are tackling the subject of Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn, the 16th century Queen of England, the woman who died, who was beheaded, the second wife of Henry VIII, the woman who brought down Catholicism in England. By coincidence, is what historians are saying. And when we are looking at Anne Boleyn, we're kind of thinking, why is she a subject of the Spirit Revolution? Isn't she well known? She is out there. She has got a number of best-selling books to her, both fiction and non-fiction. And unlike Mary Magdalene, who's about 2,000 years old, we have historical records of her, don't we? We know everything there is to know about Anne Boleyn. Well, guess what? No. That's not the case. In fact, when we'll actually come to how we got interested in Anne Boleyn, but when we began to look into her, even though she is part of the historical age, and you would think that she is very happily and well treated by historians and like, nothing is at all the case. Anne Boleyn is, just like Mary Magdalene, a woman who is being completely misrepresented. And rather than just being represented, what actually isn't coming out is of extreme importance, because once again, Anne Boleyn is one of those people who was a true spirit revolutionary, and the Reformation, rather than an accident of history, the way it is always and everywhere portrayed, was a very deliberate revolution of the spirit, which, in retrospect, hasn't really been identified as such. So, Kathleen, how did we become involved in Anne Boleyn?
Well, I do want to say and emphasize that Anne Boleyn was a true spirit revolutionary, which is precisely the reason why she is maligned and misunderstood. I mean, this is a pattern that we talk about all the time. This is certainly the basis of my work. Women specifically who are revolutionaries in a spiritual manner, or who are powerful in a time when it is dangerous to be female and powerful, tend to come to a bitter end. Anne Boleyn is the first Queen of England who was executed, and there is a very, very powerful reason for that. Now, the funny thing is, we did not come into this subject gently or even willingly. A lot of women in my generation, I'm 47 years old, grew up in Los Angeles. A lot of American women in my generation grew up sitting with their mothers and their grandmothers, as I did, watching PBS and watching a series called The Six Wives of Henry VIII and Elizabeth R. And I know I can hear you out there going, yes, yes, I did, because I get these letters all the time and I talk to women about this all the time, and a few men too. But for some reason, there was something in this generation. There was a real fascination with the Tudors long before Showtime resurrected it with their series, and long before people like Philippa Gregory showed up with their nonsense. Oops, did I say that out loud? We're going to get back to Philippa Gregory, because the other Boleyn girl is a real bee in my bonnet right now, and I want to talk about it. And one of the reasons the other Boleyn girl is a bee in my bonnet is when I first read it, I thought the book was brilliant, and I think a lot of people do. And I was completely captivated by the story, and I was thrilled by this idea that there was a lost Boleyn girl, and she was the one who had been maligned and misunderstood. And for a number of years, I truly was on that bandwagon that poor Mary Boleyn was the girl we should be focusing on. However, in my research and yours, we have discovered that nothing could be further from the truth. The research as such, and if you could see me, you could see me putting it in air quotes, in The Other Boleyn Girl, is so shoddy and so specifically skewed to make Anne Boleyn look like a whore by telling Mary's story, that this is one of the lies that really, really has to be exposed about Anne's life. But I digress. My friends. So let's go back to, I grew up fascinated by Henry and his wives, and a lot of people have. And the thing is that Anne is an incredible source of fascination for so many people. I mean, right now, if you Google her name, there are anywhere from usually 950 to over a million hits on Anne's name. There are hundreds of thousands of websites that are either devoted to her or devoted to Tudor subjects that feature her. USA Today, April 8th of this year, USA Today ran a front page of the feature section, you know, Tudor Mania headline about how Tudor Mania isn't going away. If anything else, it's getting bigger. More and more people care about this story. And the article compared Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. They are the superstar, tabloid-worthy king and queen of history. So these are actually all the reasons that I did not want to talk about Anne Boleyn. I thought, you know, she had been done to death. There was nothing new to say about her. You know, I thought that, you know, because my perspective on women is that they powerful women are maligned and misunderstood, I certainly believe that she was not the schemer that we have been shown by all of these media depictions and all of these novel forms. And even these history books, there's me with the air quotes again, because these history books about Anne actually commit the gravest errors, gross factual errors, as well as interpretations that are not to be dealt with. But we didn't want to do anything on Anne Boleyn. I had no intention of doing anything on Anne Boleyn. We were actually looking at characters around Shakespeare and something that was more of a scandal about the Shakespearean period. And Anne Boleyn kind of kept pulling us in. Every time we were looking at the Elizabethan era, we'd look at Elizabeth, and then something would take us to Elizabeth's family, and then we'd start looking at her mother, who is, of course, Anne Boleyn. And, you know, we kept being pulled back to Anne. And I kept saying, no, this is not about Anne. Let's stay where we are. But as we continued to dig, you and I came upon a couple of things that rocked our world, and we both went, oh, my God, what people are saying about Anne is potentially not only untrue, but I believe this is the biggest conspiracy in history outside of the whoring of Mary Magdalene.
Yes, and we'll come back to, I think, some of the clues in art and in her writing, which kind of like put us on the trail to realize that Anne wasn't at all who people had pretended she was, that there was far more depth to her, and if the depth is of a far different type than people who do kind of like see that there is some depth there are actually making it into. But one of the things which I found truly amazing was that when you were doing research for the Poet Prince, you delved into the Renaissance, you delved into the Medicis. The rulers of Florence in the 15th century become the most important people in Europe. They are, because already even before they put people of their family on the papal throne, they're already bankrolling the Vatican. They are the Pope's bankers. So they control Europe. They have created the financial system, which is still today in place. Might not be for much longer, but it's definitely their world. And so what we see is that take 1500, take every European history, continental European history, and you will see the Medicis there. You will see Catherine de Medici in France. You will see popes Leo the 13th. Leo the 13th is somebody else. And Clement VII being leaders of the church. And both of them are basically brothers, not genetically as such, but definitely in spirit. They have been raised together. They are part of the same family. When Leo X is Pope, already the future Clement VII is his right-hand man. This is the Medici ruling Europe. And so when we start looking into Anne Boleyn, we find the classic quote, Anne Boleyn was trying to get in marriage with Henry VIII. However, Henry VIII was married to Catherine of Aragon. So Henry VIII went to Pope Clement VII to get his marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled. And the Pope said no. As a result of this, Henry VIII breaks with Rome, annuls his marriage single-handedly, roughly creates the Protestant Church, and marries Anne Boleyn, and goes on to kill her 2 years roughly later. All of this hinges on Clement VII being a person who says no to Henry VIII. And it's almost as if Henry VIII is begging somebody far away. Compare it to the president of Albania trying to get a favor from Obama. And, you know, Obama has never heard of this president of Albania. And why would he indulge this president in his fantasy of whatever he wants? Well, guess what? History is so different. And when we started digging into the books and the leading books on the Anne Boleyn research, we find that none of them mention how Henry VIII and the Medicis were best buddies. From 1515-ish onwards, you find that the Medicis identify England and Henry VIII, who is a relatively young ruler at the time, as a very important player on the European battlefield. And of course, because he's King of England. By 1516, there is a thing whereby all the leaders of Europe, when they want to speak to the Pope, they have a cardinal assigned to them. And that title, that cardinal, is called the Cardinal Protectorate, or Protector. And the Cardinal Protector for England at that moment in time becomes Giulio de' Medici, the future Pope Clement VII. So 15 years before, Henry VIII asks Clement VII to annul the marriage, his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. He knew throughout that period the Pope. And this is something, this is a very simple fact. It's a biographical fact. Yet in none of the books on Anne Boleyn, which we have consulted so far, and they're all the leading books, nobody underlines this point. And it's such an important point. It's like they have known each other almost as best friends. Yet why does he not get this done from his best friend? And it's one of the pivotal questions of history which nobody has been able to answer, or let alone ask. And the two do go together. Now, for those of you who've been reading Poet Prince, you kind of get the idea as to why there might be something not that straightforward, because we all know that the Medicis have certain agendas of their own which go against what the papal intentions had been for a number of years. For example, we know that Giulio de' Medici's father has been murdered by the Pope, and this is the guy who might want to therefore delimit the power of the papacy. And then questions should arise, like, you know, is this guy doing this because he knows that by doing nothing whatsoever, Henry will break with Rome and Europe will be scattered? This Catholic unity, which up until that moment in time is very much the strength of Europe, will forever be gone. And those are very important questions, and nobody asks them. And this is kind of like why we felt that what was going on around the time of Anne Boleyn, involving Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII, is far more than what really is being portrayed in the standard works of history.
Okay, I want to recap this a little bit, because you have just elaborated on an incredibly complex and large, broad point in European history. And I think people who are new to this subject are probably sitting at home going, whoa, I need to rewind that about 10 times, because it is complicated. So I just want to kind of bullet point it a little bit, because this is really critical. First and foremost, here I want to say this. You will not find this basic historical fact. And I'm usually the one who says there's no such thing as historical fact. But there are certain things. We know when certain people take certain positions. We know when Henry became king. We know when Cardinal Giulio de' Medici becomes Pope Clement VII. These are facts, okay? Those are the things we know. Everything else in between that fills all that stuff in is interpretation, okay? But the fact is that Cardinal Giulio de' Medici becomes Pope Clement VII. And this matters for a lot of reasons. Now, for people to truly understand what happened with Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII and the larger picture of this revolution spiritually that is happening, this reformist revolution, because Anne Boleyn was a gigantic reformer, and we're going to talk about her history on the continent and who her influences are in a minute, because that is crux of this issue. But in order to truly understand this, you have to understand the Medici. Because I think a lot of people out there are going, whoa, wait a minute, where did the Medici come into this? All of a sudden we're talking about Italy and Italian families and all this intrigue. You know, what has this got to do with Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn? Well, it has everything to do with it. And this is the problem. The problem is there are no history books out there who cover this. I challenge you, oh, Tudor fans and Boleyniacs, to go into your Eric Ives and your Alison Weirs, ugh, and even your David Starkeys and your Antonia Frasers, and see if you can find any information about Henry's relationship with Cardinal Giulio de' Medici prior to him becoming Pope Clement VII. Nobody mentions it. And so my question is, why don't they mention it? Do they not mention it because they don't know? They didn't dig deep enough? Do they not think it's relevant? And how can you not think it's relevant? It's a very, very curious thing. But one of the things I've noticed about Tudor history is that Tudor history tends to happen in a vacuum. For example, Tudor historians tend to look strictly at Tudor history in terms of the question of England. And what we are finding is so important. This is such a complicated subject that spreads across the entire continent of Europe and really impacts the Western world that you can't stop in England. You have got to look at the history of Italy. You've got to look at Spain. You've got to look specifically at France and everything that is happening and has happened spiritually in all of those nations, because it all matters to this story. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm plugging my own book, or I don't want this to be a big commercial for Poet Prince, but if you want a really easy way to understand the Medici aspect of this story, you will find it in my book, The Poet Prince, and it's important because this character of Giulio de' Medici is the linchpin to this entire history. Giulio de' Medici is the nephew of Lorenzo the Magnificent. He is the son of Lorenzo's brother, Giuliano, who is murdered by agents of the Pope on the floor of the cathedral on Easter Sunday, leaving little Giulio, the newborn baby Giulio, an orphan, because his mother dies basically in childbirth. So Lorenzo adopts this child, Giulio de' Medici, and raises him, who is his nephew, as his son. He raises him with his own son, Giovanni, who becomes Pope Leo X as the big brother. Once Pope Leo X passes, his little brother, who is actually his biological cousin, Giulio de' Medici, becomes Pope Clement VII. You have to remember that these Medici boys had a real desire, a burning desire, a mission to reform the Catholic Church from the inside out. You have to remember that they let Martin Luther run rampant and don't stop him. Leo X does not curb Martin Luther for 3 years. He lets him go for 3 years before finally pronouncing a sentence of excommunication. So what we're seeing here is that these Medici brothers have a real strong need and desire and passion to eradicate Catholicism in its current state and reform it into something new. And they're doing it from the inside, which is very, very clear. So in the middle of this grand plot for the Medici to take over the church and reform it, you have little Giulio de' Medici becoming a cardinal at a very young age and then being hired by Henry VIII. He is appointed by Henry VIII, not by the Pope, but by the young Henry VIII, brings Cardinal Giulio de' Medici over to the UK, which is then Britain, over to London, and makes him the Cardinal Protector of England. And nobody talks about this. So now the Cardinal Protector of England is young Giulio de' Medici, who becomes very close to Henry. There's very little documented about his time in England. Very little. It's very difficult to find information on it. We have been lucky. We've got some antique books. We've been doing a lot of digging, and we're going to continue to dig. I think we're going to find more information in the Italian sources as we continue our research. But what we're seeing here is essentially Giulio de' Medici lived possibly with Henry for several years before ultimately going to France and then ultimately becoming Pope Clement VII. So whether or not you buy into conspiracy theory, you have to ask yourself this incredibly important question. Henry brings Giulio de' Medici over to become the most important spiritual force outside of the Archbishop of Canterbury in Britain. And no one talks about it. It's not in any of the history books. And we don't see Clement VII crop up until basically he says no to Henry. But there's something deeper going on here, and no one's talking about it. And that's what we're about here. We are about looking at these aspects of history that are so critical, but have been completely left behind for all of the garbage tabloidy stuff that we're getting instead. And that's going to ultimately lead us into a discussion about Eustace Chapuis, and who is considered the primary source on Anne Boleyn, and why she has developed such a negative reputation as a result of the focus on this tabloid trash as opposed to the important historical significance of what's really happening in the Western world.
Yes, and I think one of the interesting aspects to kind of like finish off the Medici part of this is that when historians look at the Medici, they kind of like see how they say like he was very strong as in his role as cardinal protector. He was a very strong man when he was dealing with this bit as a cardinal. He was very strong. And then he becomes pope and they kind of go, and then he was really weak. Because he didn't do anything with Martin Luther for, as you said, a number of years. He didn't do anything at all with Henry VIII. But guess what? When you start looking into the correspondence and the material, when he is Pope, he writes to the new Cardinal Protector of England, who's telling Clement VII, you know, there's an issue here. What am I supposed to be doing? And Clement VII specifically says, stall. Do nothing whatsoever. Pretend you're doing something if you want to, but basically don't do anything. And so it's not just like that Clement VII doesn't know what he's doing or kind of like thinks, oh, you know. He gives specific orders, wait. Because guess what? Might it be the case that Clement VII knows that by doing nothing whatsoever, Henry will take the initiative and will break? Just like by pretending to be weak against Martin Luther, he knows Martin Luther will get the advantage. The Medicis were extremely intelligent people. Once you give certain thing a momentum, when you do not nip it in the bud, the person who has begun to do this is probably likely going to succeed. And so the only thing you need to allow for that thing to happen is to give that somebody some breathing space. And so the question is completely different. Like, historians just say this. When Giulio de' Medici became Clement VII, when he became Pope, this strong character somehow became weak. And it's probably got to do with the fact that he became Pope and he couldn't deal with the stress of the daily routine of the Vatican and all of these people. The other question which might be answered is this, or asked rather, is this. When somebody becomes Pope whose father has been murdered on papal orders and who knows why it happened, even like, you know, it's even beyond revenge. Revenge was the lowest thing he wanted. What he wanted to do was to make sure that this could never happen again. And that is, of course, very hard because the Vatican comes with an awful lot of power. But he could intervene and try to stop the genocides of, like, the Cathars and all of these other things, which just killed thousands and thousands in the name of religion. And that's what he was focusing on. And that is a very different question from like, oh, why did he become weak? It's not always about character. When historians start asking questions about character, you'll probably find they are lazy historians. And we'll actually come to see that with Anne Boleyn. Because with Anne Boleyn, what we saw was another person who is still considered to be by the likes of G.W. Barnard to be weak. G.W. Barnard has written a book called Fatal Attractions, whereby she is portrayed as being of no importance whatsoever. It's all Henry VIII. Henry VIII is the one who wants to marry her. Henry VIII is the one who wants to divorce Catherine of Aragon. Henry VIII is this, Henry VIII is that, and Anne Boleyn is just almost sitting in a corner, kind of going, oh, this is so beautiful what Henry is doing for me. She has almost no will of her own. She has definitely no importance. Yet, when you begin to not even dig, when you begin to look at certain things, which, again, the Tudor historians aren't touching upon, you're beginning to see a somewhat different Anne. And one of the things we were initially focused on was something she wrote in a book of prayers, which is on display in Hever Castle. It's quite often not on display on the page we're going to talk about. But while she is courting Henry VIII, she writes a very interesting passage.
She writes in French something that translates to mean "the time will come" or "the time returns." The literal translation is from the French, "the time will come." And she draws after it the symbol of an astrolabe, which is very interesting, and which later becomes a part of her personal, her own personal symbolism. And no one's ever talked about that, and no one's ever analyzed it. So those who are familiar with my writing might understand why, when I saw that Anne had written as a love note to Henry, "the time returns," or "the time will come," that I was extremely interested, because of course, "the time returns" was the Medici motto, and is an incredibly important part of the story of Lorenzo de' Medici. It certainly features in both my books, The Book of Love and The Poet Prince. So this immediately caught my attention and made me think, wait a minute, there's something else going on here that no one's ever looked into, and there certainly is. The key to understanding Anne Boleyn, from my point of view, and from the research that we've been doing over the last year, really intensively, and this research has not just been in books. We have been crawling all over the world looking for this information. We've been all over Europe. We've been to the UK. We've been to Belgium. We've been to France. Certainly, we've been to Italy. We have been to a lot of different places looking for this information, as well as the libraries and the antique bookstores. And the auctions, and the art. We've even actually had to go, we actually purchased an 18th century engraving of Anne Boleyn because we saw it online and we could tell that there were details in the engraving that had information that might be interesting clues for us. And when we couldn't see the details online, we actually bought the engraving so that we could get the up close details. And it didn't disappoint us. It was worth every penny. And we'll be revealing those on our website, anneboleyn.com, because we're the proud owners now of anneboleyn.com, home of the truth and no regurgitation guaranteed. So we will have some of this information. We'll have pictures of Anne's drawings in the margins, her writing of Les Temps Viendra in the margin of the book, "The Time Will Come." So we'll have all that stuff up online for you so you can take a look at it, along with our articles and more information about our research as we go along, because we think it's really important to start exposing these new ideas about Anne, because history is traditionally stagnant. It's sterile. It's about regurgitating and rehashing the same information over and over again. And I'm a little bit troubled that there's a new wave, a whole new generation of young historians, PhD candidates, people who are out there studying Tudor history and working on, getting their degrees in it. And they seem to be born-again historical fundamentalists. They are really committed to the material that's out there. Our greatest hate mail tends to come from these people who say, how dare you challenge the historians? Well, the historians are making tremendous errors. And the errors come from the fact that they are regurgitating the same sources. And here's the bottom line. People say, oh, well, they're original sources. But, it's the same thing that we talk about when we talk about the Bible and we talk about first century characters. What are those original sources? Well, the bottom line is the most prolific writer in Anne Boleyn's time, who has written the most about her and about the era and about everything that was happening in the court of Henry VIII, was Anne's greatest enemy, Eustace Chapuis, who was in the employ of Spain and of the emperor and of Catherine of Aragon. His job was to destroy Anne. And yet historians for 500 years have taken everything that he said about Anne as gospel. You know, some of these very acclaimed historians actually say things like, well, he was there, and therefore we have to take it as gospel. Well, you know, that's like saying Ann Coulter and Glenn Beck talking about Barack Obama is the truth. That's who Barack Obama is. He is, you know, a Muslim socialist because these people say so, and they were there. It's ridiculous. You have to look at your sources, and you have to look at the intention of your sources. This new book by G.W. Bernard that came out, I am outraged about, not just because it's trash. It is clearly a tabloidy rehash in an attempt to make money off of discrediting Anne and nothing else. It has no historical value whatsoever. And the reason that I'm angry about it is we have gone through this book, for example. We have got, and we're going to put these pages online too, we're going to put these photographs up there. We have got pages where he quotes Chapuis in 9 different places as his source on one page. So what we have is we have someone who is taking only the lascivious, salacious sources that call her a whore. By the way, this man, Eustace Chapuis, that every single historian quotes over and over again as a legitimate source, never once referred to Anne Boleyn by her name. He only referred to her as the whore and as the concubine. And don't we have an obligation as people who want to look at history with an eye towards actually learning something and encountering the truth and say that maybe a man who only referred to her as the whore and the concubine might not have been telling us exactly the truth about Anne Boleyn, might have had a skewed perspective, and yet over and over again, every single Tudor book quotes him more than any other source.
Up to the point of using Chapuis, and you know, Chapuis is there because Catherine of Aragon obviously has got Spanish blood. Chapuis is reporting into the Spanish emperor. And he has a task. He realizes that his nation, his queen, is being moved to different parts of the castle, if not, you know, completely outside of the castle. And what he's saying is, for example, that the daughter is going to be murdered by Anne Boleyn. That, you know, Anne Boleyn is going to do away with her because this way Elizabeth will definitely be the future queen. And when you see G.W. Bernard simply quoting Eustace Chapuis and going along with this train of thought, you begin to think like, okay, even if you think this is true, if you're absolutely convinced as a historian this is true, there has to be in what you're writing an argument for this. There has to be a train of thought whereby you say, A says this, B says this, I conclude in favor of A or in favor of B, or the criticism which B gave to A is null and void because of these reasons. But G.W. Bernard is just quoting, he's parroting, he's kind of saying, look, you know, I believe. And there's one quote which unfortunately I haven't got in front of me, but which will be up on anneboleyn.com in the next few weeks, because there's going to be a review of his book there. And on some occasions, not on this one, but on some of occasions when Bernard is writing, he will kind of go, I know I haven't found any single evidence for what I believe, but I just believe it, okay? Trust me, people, trust me. I believe this. And it's this kind of preaching methodology which typifies Boleyn scholars, Tudor scholars. It's lots of preaching in isolation. They treat England as a standalone island which had no contact with the outside world. They treat it as if there are only a few sources which are either in English or Chapuis reporting back to his master. And it's just not true. What happened to Anne Boleyn was part of European history. And when we began to look into how Anne Boleyn became at the court of Henry VIII, we found that she wasn't just some accidental girl who Henry fell in love with, but we found that she had been tutored by and had known some of the most powerful but also intelligent women of Europe at that time.
And this is the bottom line with Anne, and this comes back to the most important issue about her life, which, again, very few write about, and that is her childhood and her education on the continent. I believe that the primary Boleyn scholars write very little about this because it's hard to find, and it's not easily found in English, and we had to dig in French and everything else. And again, you have to go outside the Boleyn box. You have to go outside the Tudor box. You have to actually look at the larger context of French history. You have to look at who these women were and what they were doing. We were fortunate, both of us, to come into this with a strong background in French history. And I think that that is what has served us so well in this work thus far, because I can read what an English scholar who clearly doesn't have a grasp of French history is saying and say, wait a minute, that's wrong. For example, there's so much misconception about Anne's time on the continent. And one of the problems is this. Everything about her is in dispute, including her birth date. This idea, was Anne born in 1501 or was she born in 1507? Was she 5 when she was sent away to school on the continent, or was she 12? Because that makes a difference. I firmly believe and can prove that she was in fact 12 when she goes there. And it's important because Anne goes into education with the most powerful woman in the world of her time, and that is Margaret of Austria, who is the regent of Europe at the time that Anne goes to stay with her and becomes her star pupil. She is there, again, not recorded specifically, but for at least a couple of years. Now, what's interesting about this is you read the traditional Boleyn books, and they say, oh, well, Anne was either too young to have been influenced by Margaret, or her stay, one of them, I can't remember which of them it is. It might even be Ives, but I'm not sure. One of the Boleyn books that I had in my hands this week said her stay in the court of Margaret of Austria was so brief that it could not have made an impact on her. Now, if we're talking about a girl who is being taught by a powerful female political and spiritual force from the ages of 12 to 15, brief is in the eye of the beholder, people. And I don't know about you, but if you all think about where you were between the ages of 12 and 15, those are pretty impressionable ages. So you put someone like Anne Boleyn, who is by all accounts really smart, really intuitive, a fantastic student by the letters of the time, into this place, you've got somebody who's being deeply influenced by this extraordinary woman.
Yes, it's almost like saying that, let's invent a girl, Anna Marie Joe or whatever, spending 3 years with President Obama when he's president of America. And then afterwards, you kind of say, well, yeah, it's a brief period of time when she met, when she was living with Obama. And it's like, it was 3 years during the presidency, and that girl was there constantly. She met everybody as a result whom Obama met. She was part of the decision process. She saw him in the morning, she saw him at night, and she probably saw him at lunchtime as well. That's the relationship Anne Boleyn had to Margaret of Austria, the Obama of her time, the leader of Europe, the woman who is able to engineer deals between the various nations in a way whereby there's actually one biographer who pretty much says, a few years ago she had made this peace treaty across the European nations, but she really felt that it had outlasted its power and its usefulness, so she just engineered another one.
Now, Margaret of Austria is an extraordinary character, and I definitely urge people to do some investigation on her life, and we are certainly going to be writing about her in our forthcoming books and also on the website. She was a powerful reformer. She is a powerhouse of reform and of humanism. It is from the court of Margaret of Austria that Erasmus is nurtured and arrives. It is from the court of Anne of Austria that some of the great painters, the Flemish painters of that time, evolve. And it is in this environment that Anne Boleyn is. She is sitting essentially in the White House, surrounded by these people. And it is from there that she ends up leaving Margaret of Austria and then going into the court of the Queen of France. And this is where it gets really, really interesting, because what happens in history is she is there with her sister, who there is great speculation about who's older, who's younger. I believe that Mary is the oldest, again, and I believe I can prove that. And that's all going to be part of the proof and the research that we're putting out. But here we have this idea that Anne and her sister are in this court in France. And later on, Anne becomes known by the naysayers as the French whore, as the one with the licentious French ways. Philippa Gregory turns Mary Boleyn into the angelic one and Anne into the promiscuous one, when in fact the story of these girls is completely turned around and conflated. When you look into the French sources, it is very clear that Mary Boleyn is the one who is sent away from France for being too promiscuous. She was the mistress of the King of France, and according to the French sources at the time, she was the mistress of pretty much everyone else. They called her the English prostitute. They called her the English mare on whom everyone had had a ride. I mean, her reputation was so sullied that they could not get her out of France fast enough. Queen Claude did not want her there, and yet they retain Anne as the ultimate virtuous one. So later on, when it becomes Mary as sort of the tragic figure, and Anne once again as the scheming, adulteress who's willing to do anything to get her ambition accomplished, it's just simply not true. The French sources, both during Anne's life and posthumously, were all about praising Anne for her virtue, for her kindness, for her wisdom, for her strength. And these are things that the English biographers just ignore entirely. And I don't know if it's because they've never bothered to look. I think the more we look and follow their footnotes and trace their research, the more we realize how incredibly lazy they are. Because, you know, I think as shocking as it is, a lot of these, you know, sort of great biographers aren't really looking beyond, you know, the traditional, easy, usual sources. But there is so much information about in French about Anne. But the key here becomes this extraordinary character, another Margaret, Marguerite of Navarre, the Queen of Navarre, who is also the sister of the King of France. British biographers, again, poo-poo this. They say there is no proof that Anne had any kind of relationship with her. Or they say, well, Anne was not in Marguerite's court. So despite the fact that Marguerite is the greatest heretic reformer of her time, we're going to say that she didn't have any influence on Anne and could not. And this, again, shows the weakness in the arguments of the English historians, is that they don't understand French history. Because both Marguerite and her mother, Louise of Savoy, are basically running France when Francis becomes king. So his mother is Louise of Savoy, his sister is Marguerite, and during the time that Anne is at court in France with these people, she would have been surrounded by these extraordinary women, powerful reformers, heretics, feminists. There is what she would have been not only surrounded by, but embraced by, mentored by. And there's all kinds of proof that Anne was mentored by these women. She wasn't just there. She wasn't just a fly on the wall. The documentation exists that says that Anne was their protege. They were raising her to do something great. I believe they were raising Anne Boleyn to become the reformer queen of Europe.
Absolutely, and there's a very interesting passage late in life. For those who are completely unfamiliar with the story of Anne Boleyn, Catherine of Aragon marries Henry, and she has a child, a girl, Mary. And then she is unable to produce any more children. Well, some she does, but they all die young. And Henry has no male heir. And actually, on the website and in the books which are going to come, we'll explain why it was so important for Henry to have a male heir. It's far more important in his psyche than people just thinking, oh, well, he wanted to have a boy on the throne rather than a girl. So part of the reason why Anne Boleyn enters the picture, enters his mind, is basically because Anne Boleyn is a woman who can produce offspring for him. For all the other reasons there are as well, this is one of them. And the first child of that union is Elizabeth, a girl. And then Anne becomes pregnant on a number of occasions, but unfortunately, what seems to have happened is that no more children could be born from her womb, at least not full term. And Henry, whether you know the doctors identified this or could identify it at this time, he definitely knew that there would be no male offspring anymore with Anne Boleyn. And at that moment in time, the last child is born somewhere in January of 1536. She's executed in May of that year. And at that moment in time, Anne writes a letter via her chaplain to Margaret of Navarre. And it says, "The only thing more than wanting to give my husband a child, a male offspring, is to see you once again." This is a woman who is writing to Margaret of Navarre saying, "I so want to see you, and I need to see you." And yet historians poo-poo this. They either kind of go, "Oh, yeah, no, whatever," or they don't even mention it. And it's such... it's such a crime, and the crime is actually even worse when we stumbled upon a passage whereby the discussion on an earlier occasion, there is a potential meeting being held in France between Henry VIII and the French court, and at that moment in time, Anne has just been made queen. So the question is, what should happen? Should Henry come with or without her? And Tudor historians make this reference to how Marguerite of Navarre talks down and says, like, "I do not want to meet her. I just leave her there, or I'm not going to come." And they footnote this. And they footnote a French book written in the 1930s, which seems to say what the English historians are saying, until you start reading what that person says specifically and the footnotes which he's mentioning. And then you find that an English historian has actually misquoted the source on which he bases his argument, either because he doesn't understand French, or specifically because he is working towards a conclusion which is his opinion, but which is unsupported by the evidence, and he pretends that the evidence supports him by putting a footnote in there. And this is the kind of treatment Anne Boleyn is getting from historians. And it's just on, you know, we've already identified a number of places, and actually they're not that important. All the important bits about Anne Boleyn's life are simply left undiscussed.
You know, this idea that Anne wrote at the end of her life, when she is at her lowest point, where she is at her most desperate, that the only thing she desires more than giving Henry a male heir is to see Marguerite of Navarre again, is such a powerful piece of evidence. And I wanted to emphasize this, because this is actually the way that you and I do our work. We find a quote like this, and we say, wait a minute, this is important, and why is nobody talking about it? And you have to really look at it in context for a moment. Here is the Queen of England saying that the only thing she wants as much as this event, this male child, which will not only save her life, it will save her marriage, it will save the kingdom. It is enormous that she wants this male heir. And yet she equates seeing Marguerite of Navarre as being as important as that. The only thing I wish as much as giving England a male heir is to see you again. That's powerful stuff. That is something we need to be looking at. And I don't think we can just say, oh, well, there's no proof she had a relationship to Marguerite of Navarre, when she is making this the one thing that she wants as much as this life-changing, earth-shattering event. I think we then have an obligation. We have an obligation to look further and see what is really going on here. And what happens is, when you start looking further, when you start digging into the French sources, when you start buying 18th century engravings that have information carved into the back of them, when you start really digging into the record, what you find is all kinds of proof that Anne Boleyn was mentored by Marguerite of Navarre in a very personal, very intense way. And the problem with British history, with Tudor history, and Boleyn history specifically, is that a lot of these scholars make broad, sweeping generalizations without doing the work. And as revered as Eric Ives is, as much as everyone worships him as the great Boleyn scholar, and as much as he has done a laudable job with his very thorough and essentially neutral, and I say that in a good way, biography of Anne Boleyn, he is so guilty of this. He is the king of the sweeping generalization. Eric Ives will say in his books, well, there's just no proof that Anne Boleyn and Marguerite of Navarre were close, and there's no proof that these people knew each other. He does that over and over again. And the fact is, there's lots of proof. He never says, I have not found proof. He doesn't say, it's not my belief. He says, there's no proof. When in fact, there's tons of proof. What he really should say is, I didn't bother to look deeply enough to find the proof. But beware, you know, oh fans of history, as you read these, quote, history books, that every time one of these authors says there is no proof, you know, there's a lot of arrogance in that statement. To say there is no proof of anything because I didn't find it is a very arrogant thing. And unfortunately, history is a very arrogant business. So I will say that you and I have read every major Boleyn biography we can get our hands on, written in the last, you know, few hundred years. We've pulled things from the 19th century. We've got books from, you know, auctions. We've done all kinds of things. And this sweeping generalization is a very common and very dangerous thing. But over and over again, we see it being said that there is no proof when there's a lot of proof. So that's a lot of what our work is about right now. Our work now is about this idea of the truth autopsy, of taking these biographies and these, quote, history books apart and showing you all the places where these scholars say there's no proof that Anne was a real reformer. G.W. Bernard actually goes so far as to say that just because Anne had heretical books in her bedroom, not in her library, not in the palace, sitting next to her bed, that just because she had those books sitting next to her bed, there's no proof that she read them.
Or the other classic one is that, like, you know, well, we know these were given to her, but that doesn't necessarily mean she asked for them. And it's like, no, but there is also no proof that she didn't ask for them. You know, the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And that is the standard classical thing. And we're running out of time, but we'll definitely be coming back to Anne Boleyn, the heretical queen. But what is also strange, and so I think typical of historians, is the fact that they define Anne's religion within a very limited framework. She's either Catholic or she's Protestant, and there is no way in between. And as we've already been saying, on the continent she was exposed to some of the greatest religious reformers of the time. In fact, Marguerite of Navarre, if she hadn't been sister to her brother, Francis I, she might have ended up burnt or imprisoned for being a heretic. And it's actually a very interesting development in time that when we are looking at women who are dying for their religion, Anne Boleyn is identified as one by those people who believe, you know, she was a Protestant reformer. She definitely was a reformer, and I think the reform she was doing eventually became Protestantism, but what she was pushing through wasn't Protestantism as such. And when you are looking at to what happened to Anne Boleyn and what she cried out to Marguerite of Navarre, is echoed on the continent by the sad fact that Marguerite, at that precise moment in time was under so much fire internally by the professors of the Sorbonne and various other people opposed to what she was doing, that she couldn't be there for Anne. She had to save herself, and that took so much time and effort and power that nobody was there to look at the bigger picture, because unfortunately by that time, the gigantic episode of the Medici plan to break the church was in full swing, in retrospect met with great success. Martin Luther had a tremendous victory, and obviously Henry VIII broke, and England forever was lost as a Vatican ally. But the people involved were slowly dying, had died, were fighting for their lives. And I think to some extent, Anne Boleyn, when we see it as a spirit revolutionary, it is because she was one of the unfortunate victims, the ones who literally lost their head. She was not alone, but she was the one who unfortunately could not be saved as part of this reform.
This is such a huge subject, and there's so much more about Anne's faith and Anne's inspiration and what she actually did as a reformer, what she actually believed as a reformer. These are all things we're going to get into in the future. We've just scratched the surface of a very, very complicated subject. I entreat you to read The Poet Prince and get your background on the Medici so you can be prepared for where we're going to go with this and show you what was really happening in the cause of spiritual reform, spiritual revolution, which is what we're all about. So until next time, the truth against the world.